It's Glass Animals Heat Waves. We also heard Miley Cyrus.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Friedel, Gregory Stockel, Brian Lynn, and Katie Weaver. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Friedel.
American Simone Biles is widely considered to be the greatest gymnast of all time. In the United States, she is the face of the Tokyo 2020 Olympics. When the games began, she was expected to win 5 gold medals. But on Tuesday, she pulled out of the team final. She made the choice, after having trouble landing her vault in the competition's first round. She later said her mind was not in the right place to let her safely perform the difficult moves she is known for. In other words, her mind was not letting her body do what it needed to do. Cameras caught her telling her trainers Tuesday during the team final, "I just don't trust myself." So she made the decision to protect her mental health, and she said, to give her teammates a better chance at earning a medal. Biles's 3 teammates went on to place 2nd, behind the gymnasts representing the Russian Olympic Committee. Biles is not the only Olympian in recent months to talk about the pressure and mental effects of competing at the highest level. Japanese tennis star Naomi Osaka decided not to compete at the French Open earlier this summer. She made that choice after French Open organizers were critical of her decision to not speak to the media during the event. She made that decision, she said at the time, to protect her mental health. This week, Osaka lost in the 2nd round of Olympic competition. She said she felt extreme pressure to win for Japan, where the Olympics are taking place. Many Olympic athletes have discussed the stress they have felt from the pandemic. COVID-19 has greatly changed the way the games are being held. Liz Cambage is a top basketball player for Australia. She left her team 1 week before the start of the games because she was worried about entering the Olympic bubble in Tokyo without the support of her friends and family. Biles, who competed in the 2016 games in Brazil, said the Tokyo Olympics are very different from past Olympics. This time, the American gymnastics team is not staying in the Olympic Village. The team is in a hotel, away from other people. Talking about the daily life in this Olympics, she said, "There are no outlets." In other words, there is little else for her to do then think about gymnastics. Earlier this week, Biles wrote on Instagram that she felt like she had the weight of the world on her shoulders. On Wednesday, Biles announced she was pulling out of her next big event, the individual all-around, to focus on her mental health. The IOC, or International Olympic Committee, said it is paying more attention to the mental health of athletes. A spokesman said, "Are we doing enough? I hope so. I think so." I'm Dan Friedel.
In the early 1990s, Canada had over 3,000 troops deployed in peacekeeping missions around the world. Today, it has only a few dozen. Canada is not the only Western country to have greatly reduced such missions. The drop in numbers, military experts say, demonstrates the changing nature of conflict in a post-Cold War world. Major Tim Dunn is a retired officer in the Canadian Armed Forces. He was deployed in several peacekeeping operations. Now, he is a researcher for the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. He said United Nations peacekeeping is falling out of fashion. In other words, it is becoming less common and popular. Dunn told VOA that before the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, most international conflicts were driven by competition between the United States and the Soviet Union. He said this created the need for a neutral army to stand between them. Dunn said that most modern conflicts, like in Syria and Iraq, are too complex for peacekeeping to work. The factors that allow for effective peacekeeping aren't there anymore, Dunn said. It is not only Canada that is rethinking the value of United Nations peacekeeping. Emily Estelle works for the Washington-based American Enterprise Institute. Estelle points to the lack of public support in Western nations for the costly and sometimes dangerous missions. She used the Sahel, an area in Africa, to explain the change in operations. She said France leads the counter-terrorism operation in Mali, but is working to end its involvement and the operation. She said it is in part because of pressure within France and an upcoming election. She also said Mali and Somalia, which is facing a similar situation, would not be able to replace the influence peacekeepers have, if and when they withdraw. I'm Gregory Stockel.
Western electric vehicle makers are trying to reduce their dependence on rare earth metals from China. As tensions rise between that nation and others, including the United States, makers worry that supplies might become limited. Electric vehicles use special magnets to power their engines. Most are made from rare earth metals. The metals are not really rare, but they can be dirty and difficult to process. And China has become the leader in producing them. Demand for the magnets is growing for all forms of renewable energy. Experts say a real shortage may lie ahead. Some automobile companies have been looking to replace rare earth metals for years. Automakers in the West say they are concerned not just about securing supply. They are also worried about huge price increases and environmental damage that happens during production. Over the past 20 years, Western countries mostly stopped producing rare earth metals. Production involves complex processing and often dangerous byproducts.
Rare earth magnets are mostly made of neodymium. The magnets are widely seen as the most effective way to power electric vehicles. China controls 90% of their supply. Prices for neodymium oxide more than doubled during a 9-month period last year and are still up 90%. Companies trying to stop using the magnets include Japanese carmaker Nissan. The company told Reuters it is ending its use of rare earths from the engine of its new Ariya model. Germany's BMW did the same for its iX3 electric sport utility vehicle this year. And the world's two biggest automakers, Toyota and Volkswagen, told Reuters they are also decreasing use of the minerals. Rare earths are needed for the electronics, renewable energy, and defense industries. Because some can generate a continuous magnetic force, the magnets they make are known as permanent magnets.
Electric cars with permanent magnets need less battery power and can drive farther than those with usual magnets. The special magnets were the clear choice for EVs until about 2010, when China threatened to cut the rare earth supply during a conflict with Japan. Prices rose sharply. Now, supply concerns are opening a divide between Chinese EV producers and their Western competitors. Though automakers in the West are cutting down, the Chinese are still making vehicles using the permanent magnets. A Chinese rare earths industry official told Reuters that if political risks are set aside, China can fully meet the world's need. Now, companies are developing electric engines without the metals, or recycling more of the magnets from existing vehicles. BMW says it has redesigned its EV technology to make up for a lack of rare earths. Carmaker Renault has made its Zoe model without rare earths for a growing number of city cars that do not need long battery life. The U.S. electric car company Tesla will be using both kinds of motors.
Even though auto sales dropped during the pandemic, demand for neodymium magnets in EVs went up 35% last year alone. The magnets are also in demand for wind power equipment called turbines. For many EV drivers, distance worries may not be an issue. Most people are driving less than 100 miles a day, so for that you can have a less capable motor, said researcher Jürgen Gassmann. He is with the Fraunhofer Institute for Material and Beam Technology in Germany. Yet some companies, like Toyota, still use permanent magnets but have lowered use of rare earths. They developed a magnet that needs 20 to 50% less neodymium. The use of electric motors without rare earth metals is expected to jump by almost 8 times by 2030, says Claudio Vittori. He is an expert from the American-British information provider IHS Markit. But he said permanent magnet motors will still rule, mainly because of their power and efficiency. If the predictions are right, it is unclear that even these changes can affect the rare earth metals market. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we tell about relations between the American colonies and Britain after the French and Indian War. Here is Steve Ember.
The French and Indian War was one part of a world conflict between Britain and France. It was fought to decide which of the two powerful nations would control North America. The British defeated the French in North America in 1763. As a result, the British took control of lands that had been claimed by France. Britain was now responsible for almost 2 million people in the 13 American colonies and 60,000 French-speaking people in Canada. In addition to political and economic responsibilities, Britain had to protect all these colonists from different groups of Indians. This would cost a lot of money. Britain already had spent a lot sending troops and material to the colonies to fight the French and Indian War. It believed the American colonists should now help pay for that war. The colonists in North America in 1763 were very different from those who had settled there more than 100 years before. They had different ideas. They had come to consider their colonial legislatures as smaller but similar to the British Parliament in London. These smaller parliaments had helped the colonists rule themselves for more than 100 years. The colonists began to feel that their legislatures should also have the powers that the British Parliament had. The situation in England had changed as well. In the year 1707, the nation became officially known as Great Britain. Its king no longer controlled Parliament as he had in the early 1600s. Then the king decided all major questions, especially those concerning the colonies. But power had moved from the king to the Parliament. It was the legislature that decided major questions by the time of the French and Indian War, especially the power to tax. The parliaments in the colonies began to believe that they too should have this power of taxation. The first English settlers in America considered themselves citizens of England. They had made a dangerous trip across the ocean to create a little England in a new place, to trade with the mother country, and to spread their religion. By 1763, however, the colonists thought of themselves as Americans. Many of their families had been in North America for 50 to 100 years. They had cleared the land, built homes, fought Indians, and made lives for themselves far away from Britain. They had different everyday concerns than the people in Britain. Their way of life was different, too. They did not want anyone else to tell them how to govern themselves. The people in Britain, however, still believed that the purpose of a colony was to serve the mother country. The government treated British citizens in the colonies differently from those at home. It demanded special taxes from the colonists. It also ordered them to feed British troops and let them live in their houses. Britain claimed that the soldiers were in the colonies to protect the people. But the people asked, "Protect us from whom?" As long as the French were nearby in Canada, the colonists needed the protection of the British Army and Navy. After the French were gone, following their defeat in the French and Indian War, the colonists felt they no longer needed British military protection. The British government demanded that the colonists pay higher and higher taxes. One reason was that the government wanted to show the colonists that it was in control. Another reason was that Britain was having money problems. Foreign wars had left the country with big debts. The British thought the colonists should help pay some of these debts, especially those resulting from the French and Indian War. The American colonists might have agreed, but they wanted to have a say in the decision. They wanted the right to vote about their own taxes, like the people living in Britain. But no colonists were permitted to serve in the British Parliament, so they protested that they were being taxed without being represented. In 1764, the British Parliament approved the Sugar Act. This legislation set taxes on sugar, coffee, some wines, and other products imported to America in large amounts. It increased the taxes on European products sent to the colonies through Britain. The British government also approved new measures aimed at enforcing all trade laws. And it decided to restrict the production of paper money in the colonies. The American colonists opposed all these new laws. Yet they could not agree about how to resist. Colonial assemblies approved protests against the laws, but the protests were all different and had no real effect. Business groups attempted to organize boycotts of goods, but these were not very successful until the British government approved another tax in 1765, a tax on stamps. The Stamp Act probably angered more American colonists than any earlier tax. Under this law, the colonists had to buy a British stamp for every piece of printed paper they used. That meant they would be taxed for every piece of newspaper, every document, even every playing card. The colonists refused to pay. colonial assemblies approved resolutions suggesting that the British Parliament had no right to tax the colonies at all. Some colonists were so angry that they attacked British stamp agents. Historians say the main reason the colonists were angry was because Britain had rejected the idea of no taxation without representation. Almost no colonist wanted to be independent of Britain at that time, yet all of them valued their rights as British citizens and the idea of local self-rule. They considered the Stamp Act to be the worst in a series of violations of these rights. The American colonists refused to obey the Stamp Act. They also refused to buy British goods. Almost 1,000 store owners signed non-importation agreements. This cost British businessmen so much money that they demanded that the government cancel the Stamp Act. Parliament finally canceled the law in 1766. The colonists immediately ended their ban on British goods. But the same day that Parliament ended the Stamp Act, it approved the Declaratory Act. This was a statement saying the colonies existed to serve Britain, and that Britain could approve any law it wanted. Many American colonists considered this statement to be illegal. Historians say this shows just how separated the colonies had become from Britain. Colonial assemblies were able to approve their own laws, but only with the permission of the British Parliament. The colonists, however, considered the work of their assemblies as their own form of self-rule. Britain canceled the Stamp Act, but did not stop demanding taxes. In 1767, Parliament approved a series of new taxes called the Townshend Acts. These were named after the government official who proposed them. The Townshend Acts set taxes on glass, tea, lead, paints, and paper imported into the colonies. The American colonists rejected the Townshend Acts and started a new boycott of British goods. They also took steps to increase manufacturing in the colonies. By the end of 1769, they had reduced by half the amount of goods imported from Britain. The colonies also began to communicate with each other about their problems. In 1768, the Massachusetts General Court sent a letter to the legislatures of the other colonies. It said the Townshend Acts violated the colonists' natural and constitutional rights. When news of the letter reached London, British officials ordered the colonial governor of Massachusetts to dismiss the legislature. Then, they moved 4,000 British troops into Boston, the biggest city in Massachusetts and the biggest city in the American colonies. The people of Boston hated the British soldiers. The soldiers were controlling their streets and living in their houses. This tension led to violence.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.